Welcome to the History Slam podcast from ActiveHistory.ca. Here's your host, Sean Graham.
Thank you, Adam. Welcome to the History Slam, everybody. I am Sean Graham coming at you today nearly live. We are in Cambridge, Massachusetts. It's our last episode of 2015. And for those of you who are listening to this on the day we post it, if you check out Active History next Friday, which is December the 18th, Aaron Boys and I will have our third annual Year in Review 100 Years Later bracket. So this year we'll be reviewing 1915 and determining what the most important event of 1915 was through a bracket. So if you want to check that out, it's the third time we've done it. We'll have that next Friday. But today we are talking about a really interesting book written by a faculty member here at Harvard, Kirsten Weld. She is from the History Department, and her book is titled Paper Cadavers, The Archives of Dictatorship in Guatemala. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So this book comes out of not only your interest in the Guatemalan Civil War and you're a historian of Latin America, but also your involvement in the process that rescued these archives following their discovery. So let's start with that, this archival process. So Guatemala has a civil war, 30-year civil war, and then afterwards, 10 years after the war, they find all this archival stuff of the National Police in a basement?
Yeah, basically. It's not technically a basement. It is okay. Ground level. But essentially what happens is the Civil War in Guatemala concludes in 1996. The peace negotiations that conclude that Civil War allow for the creation of a National Truth Commission that's backed by the UN. And that Truth Commission, its three commissioners, are theoretically supposed to have access to any and all materials that they deem necessary in order to carry out their mandate, which is to investigate violations of human rights committed over the course of this 36-year civil war. Violations of human rights, which were massive, considerable, systematic, state-led. And so the commissioners went to the sitting Guatemalan government and said, you know, it would be very helpful in our investigation to have access to military and police records, since it was very evident during the war that it had been the military and the police, that it had been state security forces who had been responsible for the vast majority of those wartime human rights violations. But the sitting government at the time was a very conservative, military-allied government. Part of the issue with the Guatemalan peace process was that the military remained in power, essentially behind the scenes. And so that sitting government essentially stonewalled the truth commissioners and said, you know, those records have either been destroyed or they've been lost, or we can't turn them over to you for reasons of national security, so you're on your own. And then when the commissioners produced what became the final report of that truth commission, which was this incredible 12-volume, exhaustive investigation of systemic racism and exploitation over a 500-year span. It's a really amazing document based primarily on oral testimonies and other forms of forensic evidence, some archival research, some declassified documents from the U.S., but no documentary records from the Guatemalan state. When they issue the report, therefore, the Guatemalan government says, well, you're just making all this up because it's not based on any documentary evidence, which, of course, that government had denied the commissioners access to. So that report comes out in 99, but there's a sort of uneasy peace in the aftermath of the peace agreement in which technically hostilities have ceased. However, there is no effort at the state level to reckon with what's happened. There is no effort in any meaningful way to compensate victims. There's a sort of this idea of let's turn the page and move on, an official history that denied the atrocities perpetrated by the state quite recently. So human rights activists continued to do their work, continued to push for justice, but they were not getting anywhere. And then in 2005, by surprise and by accident, investigators stumbled upon a network of warehouses on a kind of dusty old corner of a police base in downtown Guatemala City. And these warehouse buildings were piled to the ceilings with heaps and heaps and heaps of moldy, disorganized, rotting papers, which turned out to be the complete 80 million page archives of the now defunct National Police. The police had been disbanded as part of the peace accords. It had been, as an organization, deemed, you know, too bloodied, too tarnished by its abusive past to be able to continue existing in peacetime. It was converted into a quote-unquote new police force. But so their records had remained in this warehouse moldering, waiting to be stumbled upon. And so that is how activists found themselves with the possibility of gaining access to an unprecedented trove of historical evidence, mm-hmm. not only about the Civil War, but about the previous 100-plus years of their country's history.
Mm-hmm. And it's remarkable that this was there, right? Because you would think that if the state wanted to deny access to it, they would destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's sort of just sitting there. And the circumstances upon finding it, if I'm right, there was an explosion somewhere else in Guatemala City.
Yeah.
And they felt they needed to inspect all the old police stations.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, without going on at too much length, there was a storage depot of old munitions left over from the Civil War on a military base, also in Guatemala City, and those munitions were improperly stored in a kind of leaky old building, and basically one night, I don't know that we know how exactly, but there was some kind of spark or fire or something that ignited and caused a chain reaction, and so all night long there was this series of massive explosions, which sent all kinds of shrapnel and twisted metal and junk up into the air. And, you know, the sort of Latin American style of houses tend to have an open courtyard in the middle. Mm-hmm. And so people's homes were being filled with this junk. And so after the dust settled, it had kind of been a sort of piece of common knowledge in that neighborhood, which was sandwiched between this military base where the explosion happened on the one hand, and then this police base where the archives were eventually discovered on the other. It was sort of common knowledge that a similar arms depot was also present at the police base. And so what happened is after the military base explosion, there was a kind of neighborhood association of the people who lived in this neighborhood that was stuck between these two bases, and they went to the office of the Human Rights Ombudsman, which is an office that exists in Guatemala, and they filed a complaint. And they said, you know, we know that it's kind of a ticking time bomb, so to speak, over the police base. Can you check this out? So the Ombudsman's office got in touch with the police, said, we know you have this stuff. You need to get it out of this densely populated urban area and transport it to some facility that's not in the city. We're going to give you 3 weeks to do so, and then we're going to show up to verify compliance. Mm-hmm. So the 3 weeks go by, the investigators show up to verify compliance. It happens that the head of the investigative team is an historian and the former dean of the history program at the National University, the University of San Carlos. And so they show up at the police base and they're kind of touring the area. It's this sort of big network of kind of dilapidated warehouses. It's dusty. It's not paved. It's a, you know, it's not exactly what jumps to mind when I think of what a police base looks like. It's a sort of forgotten corner of the city. So they got there, and the munitions in question had been packaged for removal, but had not actually been removed. And so then the investigator's task shifts to carrying out a risk assessment. If there were to be an explosion here, what would be the collateral damage? What are the vulnerable targets within reach of such an explosion? What are possible factors that might exacerbate a fire or an explosion in this kind of a situation? And so the investigators are looking around and they're taking note of, oh, well, okay, there's a, you know, hospital a block and a half from here. Okay, there are these residences over here. The whole area was surrounded by this sort of vast field of junked old cars. Anytime a car gets totaled in the city of Guatemala, it gets towed by the transport ministry to this site. Okay. And so these buildings are surrounded by, it's impossible to describe. It just looked, and this has now subsequently changed somewhat. A lot of this material has been removed, but these sort of vast fields of wrecked cars stacked like four or five high. And of course, all of these cars have, you know, gas tanks that are like half full of gasoline. Yeah. So that's another exacerbating factor for a potential fire situation. So the investigators are taking note of all this stuff, and among the things that they notice are stacks of old papers all around this building. And so they ask the official on duty, well, why do you have all this paper here? What is this stuff? And she said, oh, this is just the old archives from the National Police. And they said, okay. And then, you know, put on their best poker faces, took calm note, and then, of course, ran back to the Ombudsman's office and immediately reported what they'd found. Why was this stuff not destroyed? That's kind of the million-dollar question. I think there are a few different factors. One is just the prevailing conditions of impunity in the country. It was just inconceivable that there was ever going to be anything resembling a war crimes prosecution in Guatemala in 2005 when this discovery occurs. Right. That is just not thinkable. It is not conceivable given the post-war politics at that time. Secondly, the police had the sort of role of the police during the Civil War was to essentially do the dirty work of the military, mm-hmm. but they weren't the kind of architects of the counterinsurgency per se. They were a cog in that machine, and they were responsible for some, you know, truly horrifying mass abductions, assassinations, many forced disappearances of urban activists. But they weren't the people at the top. That was the army. And so I think there was this sense that the police records were lower priority,
right.
that it wasn't as sensitive a material, that really human rights activists' demands for years had been, we want access to the army's files.
Right.
And so initially the police files seemed like something of a consolation prize. Of course, what ended up happening was that the police files, their discovery and their rescue ended up being the thing that opened the door to a broader set of shifts in that national right. conversation about justice and historical memory and truth that made thinkable other kinds of advances on that front that were simply not conceivable prior to their reappearance.
Right. Now, they find these documents, though.
Yeah.
Poor condition.
Very poor.
How can you save them? Because, mm-hmm. you know, once paper gets moldy and torn and wet, it's very hard to save.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in a country that officially has really no interest in saving this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what is that process like?
It is improvised. It's ad hoc. It is lucky. What essentially happens is the Human Rights Ombudsman's office is able to secure a temporary judicial injunction that allows them to assume custody of the files. But they can't physically assume custody of the file. They can't take the stuff off site. A, right. because 80 million pages of paper is...
It's a lot of paper.
It's a lot of paper. We're talking like football fields of
right.
paper. So you can't take it anywhere. Secondly, since you're dealing with a question of potentially legally admissible evidence, you can't disrupt the chain of custody of that evidence.
Mm.
So you can't just start grabbing bundles and throwing them in the back of pickup trucks and
right.
moving them around, because then you sever the bond between the original context of that document and its present day location. So they couldn't move the stuff. What they could do was sort of try to take intellectual control of it. And what that entailed in the early days was basically sending a series of staff members from the Ombudsman's office who were unarmed and not trained to kind of stand around and try to make sure that nobody showed up under the cover of darkness to take the stuff away.
Mm.
And what they began doing was essentially kind of showing, you know, they went to pharmacies and bought, you know, flimsy rubber gloves and this little kind of dental face masks, because this site is filthy, it's mm. dusty, everything is covered in mold, the site is thoroughly infested with bats and rats, everything is covered in bat guano, there are cockroaches, fleas, I mean, you name it, it was gross. It was a truly mm-hmm. disgusting place to be, both in that physical immediate sense and also in a kind of emotional or sort of spectral sense almost, because this was a former detention facility.
Okay.
And so on the one hand, there's the sort of physical filth of these decaying papers. On the other hand, there are the sort of the ghosts of
mm-hmm.
of what you could imagine had transpired in this place, which nobody knew exactly, but everyone had some idea.
Right.
So basically what happened was that the human rights community, such as it is, which is a, you know, really small number of NGOs who get all their funding from abroad and work under very dangerous conditions with mm-hmm. not a lot of help and no government support to try to account for the past and find out what happened to the country's 45,000 disappeared people, to try to seek accountability for the country's roughly 200,000 dead from the war, kind of came together and donated, you know, what little resources they had, which was, you know, to kind of lend some plastic chairs and kick in a little bit of money to buy the face masks for the,
right.
the early members of what becomes this larger rescue team. And they start kind of with shovels, sort of digging through this stuff and seeing what they can find. And where they started was with this body of personal identity file cards. And these file cards had been kind of dumped in these big garbage sacks, sort of out back of the facility where they were exposed to sun and to rain. And the sun and the rain exposure over years had caused the sort of top layers of these piles of file cards to essentially disintegrate into like a papier-mâché pulp. and then harden. Oh. And so there was
like a protective shell.
So it ends up forming a protective crust.
Right.
So on the one hand, you know, the documents in that layer are destroyed forever. Mm. On the other hand, it's their destruction that permits right. the preservation of all of the other documents in the pile beneath them.
Right.
And so they start pulling out these file cards and find that, you know, on the backs of these file cards on Everyday Citizens, which were, you know, open, the files are opened up just through the normal process of someone applying for a, Guatemalans have an identity card called a cedula. So it's kind of like a driver's license.
Okay.
But when you apply for it, you go and you they open a file for you with the police. And so there are these files on everybody. And on the back of these files, they started finding consistently notations of a political character.
Oh.
So that so-and-so is a subversive, so-and-so is a noted communist, so-and-so. And so, you know, immediately they could see that these records were going to be able to provide an evidentiary link between sort of routine police information gathering and political repression, targeted political repression. So that's where they started. And what was interesting about the way that the project was able to kind of constitute itself, particularly because the Guatemalan government said, we're not going to do anything to help you. We don't have the resources. We definitely don't have the political will. We would rather that all of this just went away. Was because it was human rights NGOs who sort of took it upon themselves to do this work. These are NGOs that had long relationships with foreign, particularly European funders. So the international cooperation wings of governments like Sweden, Switzerland, Denmark, Spain. And so it was the Human Rights Ombudsman's Office, which had these relationships with these funders who were funding many other aspects of the Ombudsman's Office's work, like right. its HIV prevention office and its office for the status of women and its office for the status of indigenous peoples and other kinds of human rights related right. work that were coordinated under this office. And so the Ombudsman was able to go to them and say, look, we need help. And early on, international funders said, yes, because there is a human rights dimension to this, because this fits into our funding agendas related to the promotion of peace and security in difficult Latin American places like Guatemala and Colombia. Yes, we can allocate funds, and yes, we can allocate perhaps, you know, more importantly, political capital and political support to make sure, A, that you can get some of the resources you need to start imagining what it would look like to rescue something of this magnitude. This is the largest discovery of secret state records in Latin American history.
Mm-hmm.
But B, so that as you are trying to figure out how to do that work, nobody can make the archives disappear.
Right. Because that's a concern.
That's a concern.
At the time. Like,
it's a big concern. Yeah. People try to blow it up. There are attacks under the cover of darkness. There's surveillance of the people who are working on the archives team. There are attacks against the Human Rights Ombudsman's Office, both frontal in the sense of military officials marching into the office and demanding to see the list of employees at the archives project and demanding the firing of the leader of that project, who was a former guerrilla commander. And then threats that were less immediately attributable to a particular person or institution, but were, you know, no less terrifying. And these are the sort of Molotov cocktails being thrown into the
right.
site at night, or someone shot up the front of the Ombudsman's office about a week after the archives were first discovered. The judge who issued the injunction giving that temporary custody of the archives to the Ombudsman's office had her home shot up. She was threatened with being fired and blacklisted from her job, etc. So, yeah, there were real concerns there. And those concerns persisted even well beyond the early days of the project, but certainly in the early days of the project were palpable, because it's not uncommon at all in Guatemala still to this day for people involved in social justice work of different types to have their offices ransacked, mm-hmm. to be followed, to be tailed, to be physically attacked, and even to be killed or disappeared. That's still ongoing. So there was very much a sense at the beginning that this was dangerous work.
It's crazy to think that going to an archive or putting together an archive could be dangerous. Like whenever I go to an archive, I never feel like I'm in danger, other than maybe from dust or something. Like, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's such a different experience that these people are having.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, it makes sense, because it is a very personal, very contested history for so many people,
mm-hmm.
that it brings up a lot of emotions. And apart from the possible legal ramifications,
mm-hmm.
it's such a deeply personal thing. So it does make sense. Now, how do you get involved in this project?
So I'm a grad student at the time, and, you know, I was already in a Latin American history program. I had already spent time in Guatemala. I wasn't 100% committed at the time to writing my dissertation about Guatemala, but that seemed like that was where things were headed. And I was very interested in sort of post-war questions. I was very interested in declassified documents and had always followed the work of outfits like the National Security Archive in D.C. with great admiration. So these archives, the police archives in Guatemala, were discovered in July of 2005, but the news was kept very much under wraps because the people who were involved in that project didn't want to run around advertising, hey, we found all of this incendiary material that's finally going to allow us to put all of these very powerful, threatening people in jail, right? They didn't want to run around advertising that until they had taken some control of the situation.
Sure.
And then what they ended up doing was deciding by November of that year that the time was right to break the news internationally, again, because there was this history of close relationships and solidarity between the human rights community slash what remained of the left in Guatemala and sympathetic actors internationally, be they European funders, be they people working in human rights organizations in Canada and the United States and elsewhere. And so it was November of 2005 when an article came out in the New York Times, and I saw the article and I just knew. I was like, somehow this is amazing. I don't know what it is yet, but I want to figure out a way to be involved in this story. And so the National Security Archive, and particularly Kate Doyle, who was the director of its Guatemala and Mexico programs, had already been collaborating with what became the Police Archives Rescue Project in Guatemala and advising them, because she had been involved in other kinds of efforts to rescue caches of formerly secret documentation. And so, you know, she's a person who is very knowledgeable. And so she was kind of consulting with them, giving them advice about how to handle things. And so basically I put myself in touch with her. She had agreed to coordinate or to sort of serve as a kind of vetting person for any foreigners who expressed an interest in helping out. And what ended up happening was that there were a few different people who expressed an interest in getting access to the files.
Okay.
Because they want, you know, the historians love to fetishize quote-unquote virgin documentation, right?
Sure,
so there were historians who thought, you know, ooh, I want to get in here before anybody else does.
Right.
And that wasn't what I was after. What I was after was I wanted to be there to watch how Guatemalans were going to deal with this totally unthinkable discovery. What was going to be that story? How were they going to figure out how to handle this? What were going to be the consequences? What was it going to lead to? I had a kind of more sort of ethnographic take on the question. And so I got in touch with the project through Kate Doyle and said, basically, I have funding that will allow me to volunteer on the project. I want to help you rescue the stuff.
Right.
If you need an extra set of hands, if that's useful. And then eventually I'd like to write a book about what you're doing. But we can talk about that later. But, you know, I'd like to help out now. And I don't want access to the content of the files.
Right.
What I want access to is the process by which the files are being handled. And for whatever reason, they said yes. I think because there was the idea that there's a long tradition in Guatemala of what's called human rights accompaniment, where, you know, this is a... It's an interesting process, but basically volunteers from abroad, this is definitely the case during the peace process, would go and live in rural Guatemalan communities where, for example, a exhumation of a mass grave was taking place, or if there was an active court case involving reparations for a particular community, you would have a foreign observer or two who would go live in the community, and the idea was that having the presence of a foreign actor added some measure of security. Now, whether or not that's true is hard to assess, but because there was that sort of tradition of thinking about the potential benefits of international solidarity, I think they said, well, if we've got a foreigner who's on site all the time, every day, maybe that can help us. And if this is a person who wants to, you know, try to help us tell this story, all to the good. And so I showed up in May of 2006, so about 8 months after the archives were discovered for the first time. And then over the course of the ensuing year and a half, spent 6 or 7 months working on the project as a volunteer because I was a historian. That was, you know, they were like, you're a historian, so you can work on the history team, even though I was like, well, I'm a second year graduate student. I'm only sort of a historian. I'm a historian in process. But so I was paired with a local historian, and we started basically opening up grain sacks of records that nobody had opened for however many decades, and looking for information specifically about the death squads and paramilitary organizations that had operated from within the police. Because part of the thing with archives is that archives are the collected records produced by a records-producing institution or organization over the course of its operational affairs.
Right.
And you can't understand the meaning of the archives, the organization of the archives, the way that the archives were used in history, unless you understand something about how the organization that produced those archives actually operated.
Right.
And because this is a police organization that had operated essentially in secret, nobody even really knew, like, what was the structure of the police?
Right.
How many units were there? Who reported to whom? How many officials were, you know, in charge of this piece or that piece? How did this wing of the police relate to this other one?
Mm-hmm.
To which unit of the police was this particular death squad appended? In which years did this particular death squad exist? At what point did it change its name from X to Y?
Mm-hmm.
All of these were questions that needed to be answered in order to make sense of the documents. And so what we did in those early months was to try to dig up anything we could. And some of that work was done inside the police archives, and some of it was done, you know, in the newspaper archives elsewhere,
right.
or from secondary sources, but to try to write up preliminary reports on, you know, what was Commando 6, which is probably
sure.
the most notorious of these death squads in the late 70s and early 80s. What was the COC, which was a unit of the police that handled police-military communications. So when mm-hmm. the military would basically want to pass on an order to the police, they would do it through that agency.
Right.
But the existence of that agency was not something that was known
mm-hmm.
until we were able to get into those files.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what I did. And then basically by virtue of having spent a lot of time there, working in the same really unpleasant, difficult conditions as all of the Guatemalans, because I was the only foreigner who was working there on a kind of day-in, day-out basis, you know, and building relationships with people by sitting around with them on the coffee break and talking about their lives and, you know, being there with them elbow to elbow, opening
yeah.
up these disgusting flea-ridden bags of rotting old paper, you know, getting the same sinus infections that they got,
right,
getting
yeah.
the same skin infections and bug bites they got. I mean, all of that stuff meant that I developed relationships with a lot of the people working there that meant that when I was ready in, I guess it would have been the fall of 2007, to start doing dissertation research in earnest, I had the kind of trust and the relationships built up that allowed me to do profound oral histories with a lot of the people who were involved
right.
in doing this work, who were themselves people who had lived through this history, who found references over the course of their daily work rescuing the archives to friends, comrades,
right.
Neighbors,
right.
sometimes family members who had been victims of state violence.
Right.
So that was how I got into it.
It's always remarkable. We were talking about this in the office earlier today, that it's amazing that groups like this that are involved in human rights violations keep such detailed records about it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless the mindset of that I find really fascinating, but
regardless. Well, the whole idea of a human rights violation is a historically specific concept,
sure.
right? I mean, you know, a police agent who's receiving an order to, you know, pick up a student activist in the late 70s doesn't say to themselves, I'm going off to commit a human rights violation.
Right.
They say to themselves, most likely, I'm going to follow this order so that I can
sure.
get my job. And then, secondarily to that, I'm going to go assist in this struggle against communists, these godless
yeah.
communists who are, you know, threatening the well-being of our society. But, you know, for the most part, kind of rank-and-file police officers are very poorly paid individuals from precarious economic circumstances themselves.
Mm.
And one of the things that was interesting, the sort of evolution of thinking that was interesting for me to see as I was working with these sort of ex-militants of the left who are now involved in working to rescue these archives, is that they would say, the older ones at least would say, you know, we're starting to see from these records that, you know, the police were victims too.
Sure.
At the very least, you sort of rank and file.
Right.
You know, I don't think that would be true of a police commander or a death squad commander.
Sure,
no
sure.
one would say that. But,
yeah.
you know, that. So, yeah, I don't think people were running around with this sort
the
of nefarious.
Sure.
Yeah, I think that
sure.
the concept of these acts as being violations of human rights is but one of the ways in which you could interpret
right.
these acts.
Right, and that interpretation also often comes later.
Yeah.
And not in the moment. So in this process, not only are you discovering these archives and writing a history that was previously unknown. You're also changing memories, mm-hmm. of, right? Like the notion of memory or conceptions that people had of not only the war, but just Guatemalan history in general. So in building that, I don't know what the right word, building that narrative, like what was that process like, and how often did you run up against roadblocks, whether they be from, you know, official parties in Guatemala or even just popular roadblocks, people who may not want to believe that these things happened in their country?
Yeah, I mean, I think the question of what is the true truth about the past in Guatemala as anywhere else is a process that's contested, that is tough, that is ever-evolving. You're never going to have, in a deeply divided post-war country, a consensus that is universal about what happened and who was to blame for it. I mean, I think the reason that a lot of us do history is because we are invested in trying to move that conversation in a particular direction that we think it needs to go in. But, you know, you're always working against the passage of time, the imperfections of memory, the gaps and silences of the archival record, and most importantly, the nature of the contemporary politics and political situation in which you're writing. So the story that I wrote in my book about the nature of specifically police violence in Guatemala during the Civil War, and about the value of the work that these contemporary activists are doing in trying to excavate what had hitherto been, to this point, been an occluded, silenced, marginalized history. There are people who will welcome that work and think that it is necessary and important and will use it for whatever they want to use it for. And there are others who will say, who will be very opposed to that. And that's, I think, the nature of the beast in a country where, you know, until very recently, the president was a former military commander who had been the commanding officer of the worst affected area of the highlands where the genocide was executed by the Guatemalan military in the early 1980s. This is the guy who was in charge of that, who prosecuted that. And 30 years later, he's the president of the country. So these are open wounds, very much so. But I think that there are ways in which it is easier for a foreigner, or at the very least, I never felt like it was dangerous for me to engage with this history and to write about this history. I felt very much protected by the fact that I had a set of privileges that my colleagues in Guatemala did not have, which is that at any point I could get up and leave, which is that I had a Canadian passport, which is that I had the embassy to go to if I needed anything, which I never had to do. And so, you know, I always conceived of my role, you know, very much as trying to take the lead from the people on the ground who had been involved in these kinds of efforts for much longer and at much greater cost than I had. And I was always very conscious of trying to write what I wrote and do what I did in a way that would be helpful to them, that would be useful to them. And I was constantly asking them, you know, what would be most useful to you? What would be most helpful to you? And also in a way that corresponded to my own sense of, you know, professional ethics as a scholar, right? And so, are there things that I observed in the course of my fieldwork that I don't write about in the book? Absolutely. That is just part of the game. I think that maybe the difference is just that I'm willing to concede that. I think that you know, people leave things out of history books all the time that are inconvenient or touchy or what have you. And I'm happy to, you know, I'm perfectly content to say that I did do that because I was balancing historical scholarly objectives on the one hand, but also political and activist objectives on the other.
And it makes for an interesting read in that it has this open joint purpose, and it sort of has this dual track that you follow along as you go through. And I think that's one of the reasons, one of the main reasons it's been so well received by people, is that it's interesting to see not just the history, but also the construction of that history that are put together side by side. And It's interesting, too, because, you know, we talked a little bit before we started recording just about the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It's a similar process in that they didn't find a stash of 80 million documents, but they they're trying to create this archive related to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and there's resistance, political, popular resistance to it for a variety of reasons. So certainly no one has been blown up or been threatened to have been blown up doing TRC research in Canada, but the resistance to it, there's a similarity there. And the unwillingness or the reluctance of people to truly come to terms, perhaps, with some of the really negative things that have happened in the past. So it's an important work in that respect. And so just that's the last question. For you, now you have, if this book comes out, what was the reaction in Guatemala? Are people positive about it, or I would assume the people who you worked with and the activists would probably support the work, but on the other side, have you been subject to some of the same reactions, threats that, came across with the archive?
No. I mean, one of the challenges there, of course, is just the way that academic publishing works and translation, right?
Sure.
And so, you know, it's not like there's a vast network of well-stocked university bookstores full of gleaming titles from Duke University Press that are priced at, you know, price points that most Guatemalan students and academics can't afford. And I mean, you know, there's a whole set of problems. Right now I am involved in having the book translated, and it will come out in Spanish in Guatemala next year. And so I think that will be the moment where the book gets out to the extent that it gets out in the country, where it will be more widely accessible to people of all stripes. And so I think that, you know, we kind of still have to wait and see.
Right.
But, you know, I'm sitting here in my office in Cambridge. I'm safe here, you know.
Right,
I
yeah,
can't,
yeah.
You know, again, there is this extra measure of security that foreigner in a place like Guatemala has, and that is the result of deeply problematic structural power distribution patterns in the world. And I think it's important to A, recognize that, but more important to try to use that safety and that security for the best purposes that we can, as mindfully as we can. And that was what I tried to do with this book.
And it's something that can be done not just in Guatemala, but it's applicable to a lot of situations around the world that, that similar things could be done. So we recommend the book, Paper Cadavers, The Archives of Dictatorship in Guatemala, Kirsten Weld from Harvard. It's a Duke University Press book. Please check it out. Thank you for coming on the show.
Thanks so much.
If you have any questions, comments for the podcast, historyslam@gmail.com, Twitter at Dr. Shawnee Fever. And if you're out and you see Enrico Palazzo, please say hi for me.
Thanks for listening to the History Slam podcast. Be sure to check out Active History for more features, articles, and be sure to subscribe on iTunes.